Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A Rhode Island-sized chunk of polar ice shelf has disintegrated along a rapidly warming stretch of Antarctica. Scientists agree it's a spectacular event, but don't agree on its meaning. Does this mega meltdown simply show us how ice sheets evolve, or tell us something larger and more insidious about climate change, about global warming? In this hour, the cold, hard facts and red-hot debate. We begin with the cold hard facts. From the remote Antarctic Peninsula, David Vaughan is a glaciologist with the British Antarctic Survey, which yesterday shared with the world the stunning news and released video images of the super breakup. Earlier, I asked him to describe the findings that have everyone talking.
Well, I think there's actually two stories out there at the moment, two stories floating about out there, if you like. There's an iceberg which has broken off the Antarctic ice sheet, which is called B22, and that's pretty much probably part of the normal lifestyle of the ice sheet, producing an iceberg every now and again. But there's also been an ice shelf collapse, and that's called Larsen Ice Shelf B, and we've been watching it retreat for the last 5 or 10 years. But in the last month, the whole of what was left of the ice shelf has collapsed into a sort of rubble of icebergs.
What's the size of this shelf, and how common or unusual is it for an ice shelf to fall off, disintegrate off Antarctica?
This ice shelf, the remnant that's collapsed was 3,200 square kilometres, which I'm sure you'll tell me is the size of, I don't know, Rhode Island or Manhattan perhaps. But the significance of this ice shelf is that we've only ever seen one ice shelf collapse in the same way. We've been looking at ice shelves around the Antarctic Peninsula, which is warming at the moment, and we've drawn a conclusion that the ice shelves, about five or six of them, are retreating, but only one before this event has actually collapsed in the same way. That was Larsen A, and Larsen A went in 1995. So after Larsen A was observed collapsing, we've actually predicted that Larsen B would probably go in the same way, and now it has. So the prophecy sort of lived out.
You've been watching this since 1998. You say that you expected it to fall off, but that the speed with which it went is staggering. How so?
Absolutely. We've lost basically 500 billion tons of ice in 1 month, and that was far quicker, I think, than any of us really expected it to go, especially when you think that this 500 billion tons of ice has not just broken off with a single fracture forming a single iceberg, but has fragmented into much smaller pieces. We, at British Antarctic Survey, managed to send a ship into the area, which really had to navigate quite a torturous path to get through the rubble of ice and small icebergs to get to the area where the ice shelf had disappeared from.
Most of us have little idea how to gauge this. How important is it? How significant is it if 500 billion tons of ice have disintegrated from Antarctica?
Actually, the global impact of this ice shelf collapse will probably be not noticeable, not measurable even. The ice shelf was already floating, so you know the fact that it has broken up into small icebergs and will eventually melt back into the sea.
So we won't see our coastlines changing as a result?
We certainly won't see a measurable rise in world sea level. There is little ecology in that kind of area. Ice shelves are incredibly barren, so there won't be a major impact on life in the area. And nor will it have a particularly great impact on the local climate. So far as this current event is concerned, it's really of interest to glaciologists and people who like to put big numbers on things, but it won't have global impacts, no.
But this is what you study all the time, and in your world, how big an event is the fall of Larsen B?
It's the biggest event that's occurred, I think. It's the biggest single change in the coastline of Antarctica that I can think that we've seen. And whilst larger lumps of ice have broken off the ice shelf, this change is probably going to be relatively permanent. It would take probably 100 or perhaps 200 years for the ice shelf to regrow, even if the conditions were absolutely perfect for it to regrow. And if the climate remains as warm as it is at the moment, we don't believe that that regrowth will take place. So in terms of learning about the Antarctic ice sheet, learning about what's processes are going on there and what actually happens when we see a climate warming over the Antarctic, it's incredibly significant.
You've said that the climate in this area has been relatively stable for 1,800 years or so, and now it's starting to change. Does that mean we may see more of the handful of ice shelves break off? Does it mean that the actual ice cap on the land at Antarctica might begin to retreat? What would be the significance of that?
Okay, well, the warming that we've seen at the moment in Antarctica is actually limited to quite a small area. The Antarctic Peninsula is about 1,000 kilometers long. It's this rocky, mountainous spine of land that pokes out towards South America. Mm-hmm. And that's actually the only area in Antarctica that we've seen this rapid, amplified warming, if you like, at something like five times, if not more, the rate of global mean warming. So yes, there is the implication that if the warming were to proceed to the rest of the Antarctic continent, then we would see more major ice shelves going. But at the moment, the only ones that are threatened are the ones around the Antarctic Peninsula. And yes, we can already see some ice shelves, Wilkins Ice Shelf in particular, which is beginning to retreat. But again, even the removal of Wilkins Ice Shelf is unlikely to cause great avalanches into the sea of ice that was on the ground based on rock. And so it's only that ice which would add to sea level rise. Obviously, we're looking much further afield across the Antarctic continent and looking for changes in the rest of the ice sheet. We see one or two areas that are showing some signs of change, but by and large, Antarctica is relatively stable at the moment.
So is the fall of this enormous ice shelf telling us more about the evolution of ice or about global warming or a dance between the two?
Well, it certainly tells us a lot about the evolution of ice and the processes by which ice is, you know, removed from the continent as climate changes. I think the warming on the Antarctic Peninsula is actually telling us a lot about climate change, or at least reminding scientists of something they probably really know in their hearts, which is that in the future, climate change won't be uniform across the globe. We fully expect that climate change will hit some areas more dramatically than others. In fact, some areas may get off scot-free, but in balance, some areas are going to warm at a greater rate. And the Antarctic Peninsula does appear to be one of those areas. There are a couple of other areas around the world which we would say are warming in a similar fashion. Northwest North America, Alaska, and the Beaufort Sea are apparently showing similar change, and also the Siberian Plateau. So these appear to be sort of three hot spots of warming, which, you know, at least over the last few decades, have warmed more rapidly than the global mean.
So the impact of warming won't be uniform, and the results, as you say, or the speed of consequences may sometimes be staggering.
Certainly in this case, the ice, you know, I have described the ice loss as staggering and the rate of the loss as staggering, but I think it is. It is a reminder that some areas of the world will probably warm at a much greater rate than others in the future. And really, for scientists, we need to be able to help society and to help people protect themselves, adapt to climate change. In the future, we'll need to be able to predict those regional changes. It's all very well, and we've actually got quite good at predicting global mean changes based on how carbon dioxide and methane levels are rising, but we've not got at all good at predicting the regional changes. In fact, it's very hard at the moment for us to suggest the real reason why the Antarctic Peninsula has warmed so much more rapidly than the rest of Antarctica. We have theories, but we can't put our hands on our hearts at the moment and say we know the reason why.
David Vaughan is a glaciologist with the British Antarctic Survey. He spoke to us from Oxford, England. We're talking about the collapse of a giant ice shelf off Antarctica and what scientific conclusions, if any, can be drawn from it. Is this further evidence of global warming or just nature having fun? After an unseasonably warm winter on the East Coast, are you thinking about climate change? Does it send chills up your spine, you can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now is Michael Oppenheimer, professor of geosciences and international affairs at Princeton University. He's also chief scientist at the Environmental Defense in New York City. Good evening and welcome, Michael Oppenheimer.
Hi. And by the way, as a correction, I no longer work for Environmental Defense. I'm 100% employed by Princeton.
All right. I stand corrected, and thanks for that. Also joining us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is our news analyst, Jack Beatty. Good evening, Jack Beatty.
Good evening, Tom.
Michael Oppenheimer, you heard the report there from David Vaughan. We're talking about an enormous chunk of shelf hanging off Antarctica, no longer hanging off Antarctica, that 500 billion tons of ice that has, I guess, disintegrated since February, that's now bobbing in much, much smaller pieces around the ocean. What do you make of this? What are the facts as you see them? Is this evidence of global warming? Is it consistent with global warming trends or something else entirely?
David Vaughan had it basically correct. This is a symptom of a very strong, very unusual regional warming. Regional warmings are hard to tie to the larger global trend because the computer models that simulate climate are just not good enough to get down to that level of resolution. However, that ice shelf had been in place for probably thousands of years, and as a consequence, I'd say that it's unlikely that it's been as warm as it is now for a sustained period for a good long time. And that, combined with the general prediction that warming will occur in larger amounts at the higher latitudes, like that of the Antarctic Peninsula, would suggest that this warming is in some way associated with the larger global trend. In other words, it probably is a sign of global warming.
So when David Vaughan says it may, this trend may be expressed in regional hotspots of warming, you're seeing this overall as still related to a global trend.
Well, the global trend is just what it says, a trend in the global average. Averages will see places that warm faster than the average and places that warm slower than the average. For instance, David pointed to some other hot spots, but there are some cool spots. The North Atlantic region has warmed less than the average over the last 50 years. Now, we have some ideas about why those regional differences occur, but we don't know for certain why they occur. All we can say is there are those variations are superimposed on a larger global trend. So the whole Earth is subject to the overall effect of the buildup of greenhouse gases, particularly carbon dioxide from burning coal, oil, and natural gas. And then around that average or mean trend, there are these regional fluctuations. So I'd say that in all likelihood, the buildup of the greenhouse gases did contribute to the warming on the Antarctic Peninsula, which caused the collapse of that ice shelf, but it's probably not the only factor involved.
So we poor lay people are always looking to decide when's the indicator that we should really be concerned now. Does this dramatic physical event tell us something as an indicator?
Yes, I think it does. It tells us that if the world keeps warming substantially at the high latitudes, as it has been, that we're going to see rapid changes in the icy part of the world, not just ice shelves, but we're also seeing, for instance, melting of the tundra in Alaska, which is causing a lot of problems because a lot of buildings are built with the assumption that they're sitting on frozen ground. Well, that ground isn't so frozen anymore. Mm-hmm. In addition, even not at the high latitudes, glaciers, just typical mountain glaciers, are shrinking virtually worldwide. Arctic ice, the Arctic ice pack, which is also a floating sea ice pack, is both thinning and shrinking in extent. Now, no one of these changes, because they're regional, could be linked uniquely to the global warming trend. But when you put them all together, scientists feel that in combination, they certainly are a sign that the world's ice is responding to the warming that is occurring.
Mm-hmm. Jack Beatty, we're all getting a short course tonight, but are you building your ark up there?
You know, Perhaps to get our attention, it won't take a piece of ice the size of Rhode Island to split off. Maybe it'll take Rhode Island splitting off. That's the problem, isn't it? It's just so hard to get your mind around the economic, social, and political implications of these scientific possibilities.
Yeah, it's also vast. Michael Oppenheimer, we're going to have to take a short break, but we'll be right back. Listeners, how are you processing hot winters and Antarctic breakups? If a vast, shattered ice shelf isn't an environmental 9/11, what would be? Even President Bush now has a global warming plan. Do you? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about a piece of Antarctica, or at least ice shelf along Antarctica. Larsen, Ice Shelf B, 500 billion tons of ice, a chunk the size of Luxembourg or Rhode Island, that in the last month and a half, has simply fallen off and disintegrated. So, how are you processing hot winters and Antarctic breakups? Is your sense of global change, global warming, reaching a tipping point? And will we ever get a crystal clear indicator that there's an emergency on? Do we already have it? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined by Michael Oppenheimer. He's professor of geosciences and international affairs at Princeton University. Michael Oppenheimer, how about it? Scientists may find this fascinating. A lot of us find it worrying, or at least don't know how to process it as an indicator. You're saying you do see this as an indicator. How big a one, and what should we be looking for as the thing that raises the alarm and says, "Hey, everybody, let's change right now"? Or is this just another Mount St. Helens, another Vesuvius, nature showing us fireworks, and this always happens? Sit back, folks, and we're fine.
Well, I take this as one of many indicators that the world is warming, and that the warming is due to something that human beings are doing, namely emitting carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases, and they are signs of what the future could look like. But no one of these indicators is ever likely, I don't think, I hope in a way, enough to shake people into shock. What people have to understand is that climate change, at least so far, has been a gradual process. But what will happen if we don't deal with these emissions is one day we'll wake up and we'll have gone too far. And because the gases, once they're in the atmosphere, are there for centuries, there's no turning back. So it's a problem that's better dealt with in advance. I also say there is one particular outcome of melting in Antarctica, which we should keep in mind. It's not something that's going to happen right away. It may not happen for centuries, but it's a potential threat that this collapse of an ice shelf does make us somewhat concerned about it.
And that is?
As you noted talking to David Vaughan, there are other ice shelves further to the south that are now much colder than the ones on the Antarctic Peninsula, mm-hmm. and that show no particular large-scale signs of change. However, if the warming that's underway worldwide is permitted to continue, sometime in the next century, the world could become warm enough, Antarctica could become warm enough, so that those ice shelves would be subject to fragmentation by similar processes that we see operating on the peninsula.
And will we be as calm then as we are about this one?
Certainly not.
And why not?
There is at least a theoretical possibility that those ice shelves are holding back the land-based ice, and once they disintegrate, could allow that ice to move into the sea. And if that happened, global sea level would rise about 5 meters, about 15 feet, which is enough to end coastal civilization as we know it. That's not a scenario that would play itself out immediately, but the fact is it looks like ice shelves are a lot more vulnerable than we used to think. That's what the action on the peninsula tells us. So it says we'd better worry about letting the world get warm enough so that those ice shelves down further south could collapse. We can't let that happen.
We're in the mood to pay attention, seeing how fast this 500 billion tons of ice has gone. If the seas went up 15 feet, what would that mean in practical terms?
In practical terms, it would mean abandonment of most cities along the coast, and even large chunks of some countries like Bangladesh. And again, it's not something that's likely to happen in this century, or even maybe play out fully in the next century. But the buildup of gases that we're putting in the atmosphere now could commit the world over the current century to enough warming so that it would become inevitable for the period later on. And that's not something you want to bequeath to the following generation.
As you say, nobody knows, but we're all kind of on pins and needles. As David Vaughan said earlier, he was staggered by the speed of Larsen Shelf B's collapse off the coast. We don't want to be staggered in a way that sees whole cities, parts of countries disappearing.
And we don't want to be staggered by one of the large ice shelves going. That would be totally inadvisable. And again, the thing to remember is that because the gases have a long lifetime, things we're doing today commit us to a future with no turning back. So we've got to be very cautious.
Michael Oppenheimer, stand by. I want to invite into our conversation Ted Skambos. He's a glaciologist at the National Snow and Ice Data Center at the University of Colorado, where they've been monitoring the loss of ice in Antarctica, along with the British Antarctic Survey. Good evening and welcome, Ted Skambos.
Hi, hello.
Hi, thanks a lot for being with us.
Mm-hmm.
Ted, you've been listening patiently to Michael Oppenheimer take on the Antarctic phenomenon we've been seeing here. How does his view square with yours? Do you see evidence of global warming in the collapse of this ice shelf?
Well, I think both Michael and David Vaughan said it pretty well. Michael taking a slightly more deeper cut at sort of how to state these facts in a way that makes it plain that the possibility exists. The consequences could be fairly severe. I think in terms of linking global warming and particularly greenhouse gas-induced warming or any other possible cause for warming in the area, linking that by something that we've seen in the regional warming within the peninsula and in the breakup of the Larsen Ice Shelf is really, it's not possible using what we can observe on the ice sheet itself. The ultimate causes are going to be a little more out of reach in terms of that data set that we've managed to gather. But at the same time, I kind of like to talk for a while about the things that we are pretty certain about, and mostly in agreement with Michael Oppenheimer and with David Vaughan.
Well, tell us, because we're all looking for certainty in this swirl of facts and phenoms.
Yeah. The polar regions actually give us a lot of information about greenhouse gases and about climate warming because of the strong feedbacks in the polar system. Albedo is very high over snowy areas. It drops down radically when you begin to melt.
Did you say albedo?
Yeah, I'm sorry. That's the reflectance.
We know libido, but this is something else.
Sorry about that. Yeah. That's the reflectance of the snow. It's very bright. It's like a bright white sheet of paper, basically. And
right.
Then when it gets a little bit wetter, just like a sheet of paper, it starts to darken and absorb
more heat.
Some of the energy.
Mm-hmm.
Additionally, ice cores record a pretty good record of climate and atmospheric composition through time. And what we've seen in some of these ice cores actually is pretty staggering when you compare it to the present atmosphere, because the record, as near as we can tell, for the last 420,000 years is that CO2 in our atmosphere usually ranges between 220 parts per million and 280 parts per million, and that relates to the cold and the warm phases of the ice ages that we've gone through.
Mm-hmm.
Now, current CO2, and this isn't a disputed number, is 365 parts per million. And when you look at the isotopic composition, we look at the fingerprint on that CO2, it has the fingerprint of fossil fuel burning. And more facts that aren't really disputed. There's no question about the physics of how the greenhouse gas phenomena actually works. It gets a little bit complicated because of the greenhouse effects that are already present in our atmosphere and keep the Earth at a temperature that's well above freezing. But in detail, there's really not much debate about what would happen if you continue to add greenhouse gases to the atmosphere. It's not as though there's some mistake and adding CO2 could never have an effect.
So you're not looking at this as a cataclysmic event when one piece drops off, but you are citing facts for us about trend lines.
Yeah.
Jack Beattie, when you hear the scientists speak, stand in for us as American and world, every man, every woman. How do we process great big global trends like this, huge ideas like this?
Yeah, while we watch the albedo melt away.
Sprinkle some Viagra, it'll be all right.
Right. I think we almost need a dystopic novel. We almost need the 1984 or the Uncle Tom's Cabin of this phenomenon to focus our minds on the possibility. Otherwise, we're lost in this lucid but in the end technical debate when what's at stake is really the question of whether industrialism, which is the way life is organized and has been for 2.5 centuries, whether industrialism is on a collision course with the biosphere or not. And if it is, what are the implications on that? I mean, we've been talking on this program about development and mitigating world poverty. And you have to ask, can the world afford to have the Chinese and the Indians at the American standard of living? And if they can't, who's to tell them to stop? I mean, the political imagination fails before such questions. And I really think there is this translation problem. We need to get a grip on it imaginatively to see it whole and to see, as I say, the dystopic possibilities in the way that 1984 did for totalitarianism.
Well, I have to say, those, I guess, satellite photos, and we'll talk about them, of this piece of ice dropping off was certainly visceral to me and I think to many others. Michael Oppenheimer, Tits Campos, Jack, let's turn to our callers. Listeners, are you freaking out or fatalistic about the global environment? Andrew is on the line. Welcome, Andrew. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm curious. How often does an ice sheet of this size break off from the Antarctic continent? I mean, is this an event that happens once every 100 years, once every 10 years, once every 1,000 years? And do we have any evidence of these occurring in the past? Do we have any idea what is the average rate of ice falling off the Antarctic continent? And do we know if that rate is going up, going down?
Good.
Remaining the same.
We got it. We'll take the question, Andrew, and thanks very much for it. Michael Oppenheimer, let me put it to you. Is this just a kind of polar cap dandruff where it's always losing ice, or is this something different?
Well, for the continent as a whole, I don't think we can say very much because the baselines aren't there to tell us the rate at which iceberging occurred a long, long time ago. I mean, there is some indirect data, but nothing very good. But for the Antarctic Peninsula, and Ted, I would invite him to come in and comment here, it's pretty clear that in the last 30 years that several ice shelves, including other parts of this Larsen ice shelf, have been collapsing at a rate which, as far as we can tell, is unprecedented. Mm. And again, that's probably because the area has gotten so warm.
Ted Scambos, come in with us here.
Yeah, I'd like to add that the characteristics of what's going on in the Antarctic Peninsula are a lot different from what's going on over the rest of the Antarctic. And we can distinguish between the ordinary calving of icebergs that we sort of expect from ice shelves around the continent and what's going on in the peninsula. In fact, that's sort of why we make a big deal out of what's going on in the peninsula, because it appears, for all intents and purposes, to be an irreversible retreat around the peninsula, at least for the next few centuries.
An irreversible retreat for the next few centuries.
Well, it would be impossible for these ice shelves to grow back under current climate, and then the question is, where are we going to be in a couple of centuries, as Michael Oppenheimer pointed out?
I guess that is the question. Chaim is on the line. Welcome, Chaim. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks.
Sure.
Before I ask my question, I'd just like to say to Jack, I'm a little disappointed in the way he framed the question of can the world afford for China and India to live the way we do.
Well, but I guess the point there is, you know, we're talking about development. You want everyone to develop, but if they develop just like the United States have, what do you think, Chaim? Wouldn't that be a drain on global?
If you let me, I'll say what I think.
Please do.
The question for us is, can the world afford for us to live the way we live?
Yeah, yeah.
Not for other people to live the way we live.
Well, point fully taken, Chaim. Your question?
Okay. So you've been talking some about the effects of the melting in terms of sea level, which is, you know, a little bit long-term, scary enough anyway. But I wonder about maybe possibly shorter-term effects in terms of sea temperature. What I have in mind is the water from this melted ice is going to be drawn into certain ocean currents and go to certain places, and I would think that water would be colder and that it would lower the temperature in the places it goes to.
That's a fascinating question. Let's put it to Ted Scambos. What about it, Ted Scambos? Are we putting more ice in the drink here? Are we going to change the temperature of oceans worldwide as a result of this 500 billion-ton infusion?
No, I wouldn't expect that. The volumes, although very large, are still small in comparison with the overall scale of things in the Antarctic. There might be a detectable area of slightly fresher water for a while with this thing. Basically, the message is it's a pretty big planet that we're running here, and even things Rhode Island-sized are small when put next to the entire Antarctic ice and ocean system. I don't think we have to worry too much about the kinds of effects that Andrew mentioned.
That size has always been comforting. Michael Oppenheimer, do you still see the global scale and this and relatively tiny scale, even of this huge ice shelf falling off, as a comforting ratio?
Temporarily, but there was one point that David Vaughan made, which I do have some disagreement with, although I'd like to see what Ted has to say, and that had to do with the biological consequences. I'm not an expert on the biology of that region, but the ice margins usually are places which are critical to the local marine food web. And I would be surprised if there were no significant consequences, at least locally, from losing this amount of ice. And Ted, do you know anything about it?
Yeah, the iceberg that calved a while back and drifted towards the U.S. base near McMurdo actually did have quite an impact on penguin colonies in the area. Ice shelves themselves are fairly barren, but you're right to point out that the coastlines can be areas that are fairly rich with marine life. Although the question then becomes, you know, this is a pretty dynamic environment that they live in anyway. Even under normal situations, there are icebergs calving and coastline changes, if you will, all the time. And so there's some question as to what we can do about it, what we should do about it. In the case of an oil spill, I think the answer is pretty clear that we have a moral obligation to do something. But in the case of iceberg calving and attempting to go after colonies that are, well, perhaps at risk because of icebergs is sort of a more ambiguous question.
Tom?
Yeah, Jack Beatty?
Yeah, Haim raised the question of the way we live, and he's very right. I'm sorry that I didn't frame the whole picture there. I, of course, meant exactly what you said. But, you know, just consider that. A certain prominent American politician wrote in 1991, and I quote, "Combating global warming should be the central organizing principle of our civilization," end quote. Al Gore. Now, he wrote that when he was before he was a presidential candidate. Then he was a vice president for 8 years, and the Clinton administration really moved backward, or at least that's what brought Ralph Nader into the lists against it. And in the last campaign, I think Gore mentioned global warming once in one debate. And why did he do that? Because we are not ready to step up to what this might mean. We're not even ready to raise the CAFE standards on gas mileage for cars. That was defeated just last week. So the political debate is so far behind these scientific realities and possibilities.
Yeah, Michael Oppenheimer, what about that? As a scientist, when you look out at the political debate, does it seem to you adequate, well-focused, or not?
Well, there are basically two views. One is the grim view, which is we've been sitting around doing nothing about the relatively profligate energy system that the U.S. has. And in the latest mistake we made is to withdraw from the Kyoto Protocol, which is a worldwide agreement to start bringing these gases under control that every other industrialized nation has agreed to abide by. On a more positive view, which I allow myself sometimes, is that it's only since about 1988 that the general public understood that there is such a thing as global warming, even though the problem was hypothesized 100 years ago. And that in that 14 years, we've got an international treaty called the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change, which has got all the countries thinking about the problem.
So things are happening. Michael Oppenheimer, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We'll be right back. Listeners, are you thinking of changing lifestyle or motoring on while the polar caps melt? Is this a warning sign or just a natural wonder? You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about a giant chunk of ice that's fallen off of Antarctica in the last month, Larsen Ice Shelf B, 500 billion tons, and it's now floating in tiny pieces compared to what it was. We're joined by Michael Oppenheimer. He's professor of geosciences and international affairs at Princeton University. And by Ted Scambos. He's a glaciologist at the National Snow and Ice Data Center at the University of Colorado. You're welcome to join us, too. How are you processing hot winters and Antarctic breakups? Is the breakup of Larsen B a warning sign or a natural wonder? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Tom is on the line. Welcome, Tom. You're on the air.
Tom, I wish you'd present a more balanced view of this issue. I think the media...
Set us straight, Tom. Set us straight.
All right. Greatly over-sensationalized this issue. I wonder if you might have a legitimate climatologist like Professor Linson of MIT talk about this subject.
Tom, we're all for legitimacy, but I think we've got some pretty legitimate guests right here tonight.
Well,
but your point.
The rest of Antarctica, other than the peninsula, a recent study has shown is getting substantially colder. So it's not a foregone conclusion that the rest of the Arctic ice cap is going to drop off. Furthermore, the Earth has been in a warming trend for 100,000 years since the last ice age. At one time, there were glaciers covering most of North America.
Mm-hmm.
They've retreated in the last 100,000 years. So the Earth, it's not at all convincing to me that, in fact, human activity, our puny human activities, could so dramatically affect the entire climatological situation. Dr. Richard Linson of MIT makes this point very dramatically.
Do you accept the fact that the ozone depletion over the Antarctic is caused by human production of CFCs?
Tom Scambos, you're saying that climatologists accept this?
I'm asking if...
You're asking our caller, Tom.
Dr. Linson has given some very different views than I've seen expressed here tonight. And all I hear is the one-sided view that we assume automatically that human activity is the cause of global warming, when in fact, for the last 100,000 years, long before industrial civilization came around, the Earth has been warming.
Tom, we got your point. Let me put it to our esteemed guests tonight. Michael Oppenheimer, Ted Scambos, how about it? Do you take Tom's point? And this is, I think, what leaves people so confused, is there are scientists who say, no, it's not that. And then people say, well, humans are still a puny factor on this planet. Do we think so? Michael, Ted?
Let me make two points about that. First of all, on the facts, you're wrong. The world hasn't been warming for 100,000 years. It got colder until around 20,000 years ago. Then it warmed up, and the last peak of global temperature was probably about 6,000 to 8,000 years ago, and actually, by and large, was getting slightly cooler since then. But when there are always dissenting voices in the scientific community. The scientific community includes thousands of people. There are always people of a slightly different opinion on some things. And when
that's actually a healthy thing as well.
Yes, it's a good thing. And the way those opinions are resolved so that policymakers get a clear message is that the U.S. government asked the National Academy of Sciences to put its collective head together and figure out what reality is, or the U.N. asked the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change to figure out what the state of the science is, and they come out with voluminous reports. The latest one was one that President Bush asked for and received on June 11th, 2001, which basically restated the facts that the Earth is warming, that warming is by and large the product of human activity, including fossil fuel burning, and that it's likely to get warmer in the future until emissions are restrained.
Mm-hmm. Ted Scambos?
Yeah, I agree completely. I think the numbers that I was talking about before in terms of where our atmosphere used to be, as far as we can tell from the record preserved in the ice in Antarctica and in Greenland, coupled with what we know about how the physics of this greenhouse warming works, makes it hard to explain how it couldn't have a warming effect on planet Earth in the near future.
Tom, we thank you for your call and for your challenge. I want to try and get some more callers in here. Jeff is on the line. Welcome, Jeff. You're on the air.
Thanks very much.
Sure.
Quick question on the hypothesis here about global warming, because I want to refer to it as a hypothesis, not as a fact.
Sure, we're there.
Mentioned. I'm a little worried that I think people look at this as somewhat a linear phenomenon. It's getting a little warmer every year, so maybe, you know, in 10 generations it'll be 10 degrees warmer. I'm concerned that we might have a lot of momentum building, as your guests mentioned. You know, the buildup of the greenhouse gases is something that goes away as the reflectivity and the amount of ice decreases. Aren't we gaining momentum? And when that ice finally melts, And of course, ice takes a tremendous amount of heat to melt just to turn from ice to water. That heat will no longer have a reservoir to absorb it. So won't we then get a really sharp reaction, sharp increase in global temperatures after that point?
A spike, perhaps.
Catastrophic levels.
Right. Jeff, thank you for your call. Ted Scambos, how about that? Jeff is saying maybe we're not on a linear climb here. Could things actually accelerate?
Yeah, absolutely. That's an excellent point. There's a lot of nonlinear responses. There's a lot of surprises for us. The Larsen B breakup is a perfect example of one where a tiny amount of warming, really going over that last step in the last 10 or 20 years, put this entire mass of ice at a much greater risk of shattering and disintegrating, which it did earlier this month. There's other nonlinear effects that we can anticipate. And in fact, in the past, when we look at ice cores again, we've seen radical changes in climate happening very suddenly, not by any means step by step in sync with the kinds of things we think caused those earlier climate changes, like tilts in the Earth's axis or changes in the orbit. It is going to be an exciting ride, especially for some places it's going to be an exciting ride, especially in the polar region.
And Michael Oppenheimer, David Vaughn again said earlier, and everyone I guess is confirming, that there's some expectation this won't be a uniform phenomena. It will be most heavily felt in particular areas of the planet.
That's right. And the place where it's being felt most significantly now is at the northern high latitudes, where, as David pointed out, there's a lot of very a rapid warming going on in Siberia, in parts of Alaska. And that's already having consequences, as I mentioned before, in terms of what's happening to the tundra. And actually, in some ways, wildlife are already being affected. The timing of the seasons has already changed. I want to go back to something I said before and just to augment it. I said that the world had actually been cooling slightly since about 6,000 to 8,000 years ago. That is, until the advent of industrialization, the levels of these gases when those started to go up about 150 years ago, that's roughly when the current warming began.
Ted Scambos, our time is running down. Final thought tonight?
Yeah, I agree that this is going to be a big challenge to society and to politics, and it's perfectly appropriate to say that the political system, the intergovernmental agreements that we're trying to form around the Earth right now are going to be key to actually solving or doing something or managing the planet in the centuries to come.
And can the United States maintain its lifestyle to the earlier question raised?
I just want to say the warming doesn't have to get out of control. If the U.S. would move towards an economy with greater energy efficiency, the technologies are there. If we started driving cars that instead of getting 25 miles to the gallon got 40 miles to the gallon, we could bring emissions under control.
Right. And profits for companies and cleanliness and energy production can go hand in hand. It's not necessarily something that's going to just cost us more money.
Art clock is running right down. Michael Oppenheimer at Princeton University, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
My pleasure.
And Ted Scambos at the National Snow and Ice Data Center at the University of Colorado, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks.
Jack Beatty, there's the array. This is not a tree that fell in the forest that nobody heard. The satellites watched the huge chunk of ice fall off, and the conversation it provokes is surely the right one, whatever your view on this issue.
Yeah, it's made a big splash. There's no question about it. You know, in Chekhov's plays, there's always a character who says, oh, in 200 or 300 years, the people will look back and they'll be so grateful for the sacrifices we made. Will they, when they look back? You know, we've devised two forms here. They both come from the same thing, the atom, the nuclear weapon, and now our own industrial activity. And we've sort of lived by the sword, and let's just hope we can manage not to die by it, too.
Or maybe take that activity and put it into effect in a way that's simply not so polluting.
Absolutely, absolutely. Think of a notion like the inverse factory, a factory that makes something and then deals with the externalities of the making.
No ceiling to human ingenuity, Jack, if it gets pointed in the right direction. Jack, thanks so much for being with us this hour.
I've got to get on Larsen B and leave.
Okay, get your snowshoes or your flippers. I'm not sure which. Listeners, you can learn more about Antarctica's melting of the ice mass. It's on our website. Log on to onpointradio.org. Amid daily reports of tragic violence, one story making headlines in Israeli newspapers has been a cause for celebration. A sometimes hapless soccer team called Hapoel Tel Aviv has been on a surprising winning streak against the major European soccer powers. Franklin Foer writes for Slate magazine and is also an associate editor at the New Republic. He's been following the team's rise. I spoke with him earlier today and asked him to explain how the unrest in Israel has strangely helped the fortunes of one Israeli soccer team.
There is a team called Hapoel Tel Aviv that is currently in the midst of competing for the UEFA Cup, which is one of the two great European soccer championships. And as of today, they were in the semifinals of this championship. And Hapoel Tel Aviv is a middling team within the Israeli Soccer League. But thanks to the current crisis in the country, they've actually way outperformed any Israeli soccer team in history. And it's happened largely because foreign players who would compete against them in this championship have been afraid to come to Tel Aviv to play them. And the ones that aren't afraid to come to Tel Aviv end up coming to Tel Aviv and are surrounded by hordes of police protecting them, and it throws them psychologically off balance.
So out of the chaos and violence of the conflict in Israel comes a winning team suddenly in Hapoel Tel Aviv. You've written that the hard-nosed captain of London's powerhouse Chelsea told reporters he couldn't come because a dental infection had spread to his Achilles tendon. These European players really don't want to go to Tel Aviv.
Right. Well, and especially the bigger the star, the more reluctance there is to take the trip.
Frank, lay the groundwork for us here. Most Americans are famously oblivious to international soccer.
Sadly so.
What are the basics of Israel and European soccer? First of all, I guess, what's Israel doing in a European league?
A while back, they competed in Asia, but Muslim countries started to boycott matches against Israel. So the International Soccer Federation took them out of the Asian qualifying competition and then tried to put them in Africa, but then the same thing happened. So as a result of the Arab-Israeli conflict, they've been stuck in Europe, which is the only federation that's accepted them, and it's been to Israel's great disadvantage. The European Soccer Federation includes the world's greatest powerhouses. So when Israel is competing for a berth in the World Cup, they're inevitably placed in qualifying matches against Germany and England and France, the great soccer powers of the world, and inevitably Israel fails to qualify.
Is this a phenomena that Europeans understand? Do they know what's going on here? Are they talking about how did this little team in Tel Aviv get up into the final rounds?
It hasn't exactly caught the European imagination, but it's certainly caught the Israeli imagination. In the midst of all the violence, you know, there are days in which killings in Gaza and the West Bank get pushed to page two or beneath the fold, and Hapoel's triumphs are celebrated. I think miracle is one of the words that's most associated with the team's good fortune in the Israeli press.
Now, this was traditionally a left-wing team supported by trade unions. They have red uniforms with hammer and sickle, and
right,
in spite of all that, the very un-left-wing Ariel Sharon has become a fan.
In the last month, the European Soccer Federation banned international matches in Europe because they were afraid of the violence. To try to reverse this decision, Sharon and Shimon Peres both made a bunch of phone calls, including one to the president of their current opponent, AC Milan, who happens to be Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi.
But ultimately, UEFA insisted that Hapoel Tel Aviv come out of its intimidating fortress, home team location, and play AC Milan in Cyprus as neutral ground. And they still won, is that right?
They won. The way that these UEFA Cup matches are played is that it's what they call a home-and-home matchup. They would play one game in Tel Aviv and then the next game in Milan, and the person who scored the most goals in those two matches would advance to the next round. So they played the first half of that matchup in Nicosia, Cyprus, and despite the odds being stacked against them, Hapoel triumphed.
So they're really riding the big mo here.
They were riding the big mo until this afternoon.
Uh-oh.
When they had the second leg of their match against AC Milan, and Milan overpowered them 2-0, advancing to the semifinals of the UEFA Cup.
So the unlikely Hapoel Tel Aviv is now out of the UEFA Cup?
Right. The fantastic story of the Giant Slayers has come to a sad end.
But it's a season that will live in memory and a little glimmer of good humor in a dark season there. Thanks for sharing it with us, Frank.
My pleasure.
Franklin Foer writes for Slate Magazine and is an associate editor at The New Republic. Listeners, we want to hear from you. If you have a comment about an On Point program, email us. Our address is onpoint@wbur.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to On Point.